Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Just a quick note. Today at 1 o'clock, you can join in for live NPR coverage of the arraignment of former President Donald Trump in New York City. This follows his historic indictment on charges relating to his alleged role in covering up hush money paid to an adult film actress in the days before the 2016 presidential election. Live coverage today at 1 on Wisconsin Public Radio or at WPR.org. Listen in. Well, before he was a physician and a professor, Patrick McBride was indeed in the locker rooms of a number of sports teams, the Packers, the Brewers, and the Bucks, and has written a book about his experiences. He's titled it The Luckiest Boy in the World. And, you know, you might think that he is the luckiest boy in the world, although he certainly had his own challenges throughout his life, and we can talk about some of those as well. But I hope you'll join in. Here's a kid from Wauwatosa, ended up meeting stars like Brett Favre, Joe DiMaggio, and a whole lot more in the roles that he played for those teams. So what do you want to know about what it's like to be maybe an equipment manager or a bat boy? Have you ever helped out a team behind the scenes yourself? Join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us the email address ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Patrick McBride, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Larry, what a privilege to be with you today.
It's great that you're here. And what really inspired you to write this book? I mean, it's a book about your you know, playing for those sports teams, but it's also kind of a memoir in a lot of ways, too.
Right. You know, I really thought it was time to tell the story about growing up as a kid in a family with two wonderful parents, two newspaper reporters that were really terrific people, but had a very serious problem of alcoholism. And I wanted to inspire young people to dare to dream, to live out their dreams, because I had that opportunity one day filling out an essay in the newspaper to be the Brewers' first bat boy. And that led to the other opportunities that I just took a chance and called the Milwaukee Bucks and then got the chance to work for the Green Bay Packers. What kid gets to do that?
Oh, yeah, what kid? Indeed, no other kid.
None. There's no other kid in America that got to work for three professional sports teams.
Oh, my gosh. Well, Parker in Madison's already online with a comment, so let's go there. Parker, hi.
Hi, Larry, and hi, Pat. So Pat McBride was my cardiologist during a sort of tricky time in my life, and what he did worked because I'm 84 now and in good heart health. I've just always valued Pat so much as a physician and as a friend. The only thing I hold against him is that he restricted my diet to one bear claw per week.
That's right.
Which hardly seemed fair then or now.
And we share that bear claw every week, Parker. You're my dear friend and my mentor as well as a writer.
Parker, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And I imagine you get lots of comments like that.
Yeah, you know, I treasured my opportunity as a physician because I had such close relationships. One of the key messages of the book is I developed mentors inside the locker rooms, which I never expected. You know, when I escaped the dysfunction at home, I was quite lost. I'm a twin. I wrote the book with my twin brother, who is the mayor of our hometown of Wauwatosa, my brother Dennis, who I treasure. And I was called the dumb twin by my teachers at school. And it was very difficult because I took that on. It was internalized. And I know there's a lot of kids out there that get told things by adults and get bullied like I was. And when I was working with the Milwaukee Bucks, I thought, well, maybe I wanted to be an athletic trainer. Maybe I wanted to stay in sports. And one day I said that to the trainer of the Milwaukee Bucks, a man named Arnie Garber, and he turned to me and he said, no, you're not going to be an athletic trainer. And I said, wow, maybe I'm not qualified to do that. And he said, you're too smart. You're not going to spend your life in a locker room. You're going to medical school. And that completely changed my life. And without that, I wouldn't have met people like Parker and all my patients, and I wouldn't have had the 40-year career in medicine that I did. And I wouldn't have met all these thousands of wonderful people. And then I became the dean of students, and I worked with thousands and thousands of wonderful medical students.
It's quite a life, for sure. Well, let's go back, and we're going to go back and forth a little bit on this between your career and your work with the various teams that you worked with. How old were you? Were you 12 when you wrote that request or filled out that?
15.
You were 15.
Yeah, which is also interesting from a child labor law standpoint. But I want to give kudos to somebody named Bud Selig, who's also a professor here now of history. Yeah. And so after the Milwaukee Braves left Milwaukee, Milwaukee was crushed. The state of Wisconsin was heartbroken. And we were waiting for an opportunity for baseball. So Bud Selig worked very hard to get baseball back to Milwaukee. So I woke up one morning and the Milwaukee Sentinel had an ad in the paper. It said, here's your chance to be a bat boy for the new Milwaukee Brewers. So I don't know what inspired me, because I wasn't sure that I could write, but I wrote a 25-word essay that said, I would like to be a bat boy because I would be doing a small part toward bringing baseball back to Milwaukee. I would hope the spirit I would show would be contagious. It was exactly 25 words. And my essay got picked out out of 1,000 kids by the judge of the contest, who I didn't know at the time was Eddie Matthews, the great third baseman for the Milwaukee Braves. And the next thing you know, I'm inside the locker room with the Milwaukee Brewers, and I was in the visiting clubhouse for the first game, and it was an exhibition game with the Chicago Cubs. And I was in the dugout waiting for the first player to come, and I heard the click of spikes, and a player stuck his head around the corner, and he said, "Hey, son, it's a great day. Let's play, too." And it was a great Ernie Banks. And I literally, I'm still getting goosebumps. I thought I was going to faint. And then he said to me, "Hey, son, do you want to have a catch?" And I'm standing on the gravel of County Stadium playing catch with Ernie Banks. Can you imagine?
Your first day.
My first moment.
Well, you had many moments like that in your time, but I do want to have you talk about what the work was like.
Oh, it was unreal, Larry. I can tell you, again, child labor laws. We would get there at 2:30 in the afternoon. I had to change my high school schedule up with my counselor, and we had 12-hour days. So we were responsible for unpacking all the bags and hanging up all the uniforms and clothes, and then running errands for all the players. There were lots. And we polished shoes after batting practice and washing all the laundry then, and then running back out. Then I got the dugout ready. I put all the bats in order of the batting lineup and the helmets in order, and picked up everything from the field during batting practice. Batting practice was fun. I got to play catch with some of the players and run out in the field and shag flies. But then we'd run up in there and we'd clean up everything in the locker room, and then took care of the game. And can you imagine kneeling in an on-deck circle next to Henry Aaron or Reggie Jackson or Carl Yastrzemski or players like that, or being in the dugout with the manager like Ted Williams or a coach like Joe DiMaggio? But after the game, we had to feed the players, so we cooked food for them, and we'd do the laundry. And I was there till 12:30 or 1 o'clock at night, and then I'd ride my bicycle home about 5 miles, and I'd get home at 1 in the morning. Then I'd have to do my homework. And I got paid $5 a game the first year and $10 the next. But you know what? I didn't mind at all.
you didn't mind at all. And you actually, was it Big Jim who was your boss?
Yeah.
His wife would cook meals?
She would make Jell-O molds and get food ready and get everything ready to feed 40 hungry people, and we'd get the leftovers.
Which was a good thing.
Oh, I was thrilled, I can tell you that. I was awfully hungry.
Oh, my goodness me. And there was something else in connection with that that I was going to bring up. And you worked, oh, I know, you ran everywhere.
You know, the moment I got those jobs with the Brewers and the Bucks, I decided that I had to do everything I possibly could to keep these jobs because I didn't think I was worthy of this, you know. So I never walked 1 foot in County Stadium, the Milwaukee Arena. So I sprinted everywhere I went. So every game I was at, I was completely drenched in sweat. So I was hungry after those games, I'll tell you what. So I ate every piece of spare bread, every Jell-O. I was a hungry, skinny kid, I'll tell you.
Pat McBride, our guest today, his book, The Luckiest Boy in the World. I just finished reading it a couple of days ago, and I really enjoyed reading it and learning about his life. And his experiences. You can join in with your own questions or comments. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Take a quick look at the news and find out what else is in store, and then back with Patrick McBride. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, having some fun talking about the book titled The Luckiest Boy in the World with the author, Patrick McBride. And in addition to being an author, he had a pretty long career, physician, professor emeritus at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. And I read his book, and I really enjoyed it. It's about his time with the Bucks and the Brewers and the Packers, but also about his life in general. It's a fascinating life. But as we talk with him, I hope you'll join in. What do you want to know about the life of a bat boy, maybe? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could send an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. And Larry in Kingston's got a story for us, I think, which we always enjoy. Larry, thanks for chiming in.
Yes, I grew up in Cudahy, and every summer they had the rec center. And in 63 and 64, we used to go to Braves games, and we got a bus ride there and back and a voucher for a hot dog and a Coke and a bleacher ticket. For 60 cents.
I remember.
And, you know, I'll tell you, every game I ever went to, I wanted to be a bat boy. And you had a great life. I know you did.
Thank you so much, because I remember as a kid, too, at the Braves games, looking at those bat boys and thinking, I'd give my left arm to be one of those kids, you know, to be around Warren Spahn or Henry Aaron. And then just 5 years later, there I was, you know, and I got to be with Henry Aaron still as a player with the Brewers, and Warren Spahn was a coach for the Cleveland Indians, and, you know, those were our idols when we were kids. And I'll tell you an interesting thing that I learned about being inside the locker room. It was going to be a major theme of the book, and what I thought was going to happen to me when I walked into those locker rooms was that what was going to be important to me was those idols, you know, the Henry Aarons and the Warren Spahns and the Ted Williams. And it was going to be about how many home runs and how many games they won. And I was going to be awestruck. And that's not what happened, actually. Within 10 minutes of walking into those locker rooms, the lesson that I learned was not how great a star they were. It was how we were treated, because we were working so hard inside those locker rooms. What really mattered to us was the character of the players. So it was how they treated us. It was whether they said please or thank you, or whether they knew our name. So there were players like Harmon Killebrew or Rod Carew or Carl Yastrzemski, for example, or Frank Howard, that would actually know our name. George Brett would take us out for pizza after games. You know, here's this Hall of Famer, and he would wait around till we were done with our work and then take us out for pizza. And, You don't forget things like that. And Henry Aaron was a first-class human being, and he would remember your name. And that's what we really valued, because, and that was a life lesson, because for us it was about integrity, values, character. I took that forward with me as an adult, because it wasn't about how big a big shot you were. It was about how you treated other people. It was how kind you were. It didn't matter if it was Willie Mays or whoever came in. I met Mickey Mantle. I met Stan Musial. I met all these. You can name a baseball player. I met them all. I worked at the 75 All-Star game, and I won't name names, but they're in the book, mm-hmm. and there's some bums in there. Mm-hmm. And I really wanted to meet people that were people that would say thank you. There were people that would walk by a laundry basket and drop the laundry on the floor instead of moving it over 3 inches. I mean, it was remarkable to me.
There was somebody else whose name we won't mention either, who used to irritate you because he would get angry and, like, knock all the bats over.
Yeah, come up to the locker room and tear the place apart just because he struck out. I mean, come on. Grow up.
And then you had to clean it up right away.
Absolutely.
Or you had to reorganize the bats and get them in the proper order.
Yeah, tear up the whole dugout. I mean, he was a juvenile.
A sad, sad story, for sure. And, of course, those people, you do name them in your book. Mm-hmm. We don't need to talk about the particular ones here today, for sure. And you, well, before I go on, let's go to David in Verona, who has a comment for us, I think. David, hi.
Hi, Larry. This is David in Verona. I was a family practice physician at the university and had the privilege to work with Pat McBride for a number of years and enjoyed every minute of it. And I wish him well. It sounds
Thank
like
you.
He's retired at this point.
Yes.
And I had the occasion one time to go over to Pat's house, and I don't remember why, but we were in the basement, and he just rummaged around a box and pulled out a jersey of Lou Alcindor. It still said Alcindor on it. And I just about fainted. I just said, how did you get that? And he told me about being working for the Milwaukee Bucks. And I've always wanted to hear the story about his career before medical school. And so I'm very interested to read the book.
Well, David, thank you so much.
Well, I'll tell you this. Thank you, David. It's very kind of you. And I'll tell you the story, actually. You know, in the days that I worked there, it was not okay to ask for things, you know, jersey or, you know, sweatbands or things like that. But I became the equipment manager of the Milwaukee Bucks at age 18 after a really tragic loss of an incredible man named Ed Goodwin. And he had died of a heart attack at age 55, and the Bucks named me at age 18. I was a senior of high school, the equipment manager. And
the youngest ever.
The youngest still ever in the history of professional sports. Nobody under age 21 has been an equipment manager in any sport. And so I was in charge of all the uniforms, and we boxed them up at the end of every season and put them on a shelf. And I asked the general manager in 1975, just about the year I was about to head to medical school, I said, well, you know, there are a lot of uniforms down there. Do you mind if I grab a couple? And he said, no, go ahead. So I thought, well, okay, I'll grab the 1971 jacket of Lou Alcindor and the uniform of Lou Alcindor and Oscar Robertson from the NBA championship year. I'm not going to be selfish. I'll just grab onto those three. And that's what Dave saw in my house. And I had those uniforms for 42 years. And it wasn't until my daughter was getting married and my wife wanted a new kitchen that I decided to part with those jerseys. But I still have some memorabilia from those. I have the Alcindor warm-up and a Hank Aaron bat. I won't part with those. Those are treasures for me.
Yeah. And your wife, it's sort of an amusing story in there because your wife is an artist.
Right.
And kind of, I don't know if she poo-pooed those things, but she changed her tune when you went to sell them.
You know, I had this cardboard box that Dave's mentioning. I had all this memorabilia that I had in a scrapbook of all these autographs. Mm-hmm. You know, I have Pistol Pete and Wilt Chamberlain, Johnny Unitas, Joe Namath, all these great autographs, Ted Williams. And and the famous story about how I got Joe DiMaggio's autograph and these uniforms and everything. And I said, well, I'd like to display them, put them up. And she said, well, that's just sports junk. You know, I had all these hats. And she honestly did not have any idea what the value of any of this stuff was. And she just didn't know about sports. I mean, when I met her, I don't think she knew if football was oblong or round, you know. And she does now. But so anyway, when I she said, no, I just don't want that stuff up. She'd rather have artwork on the wall. So I said, okay, you know. And then when I finally decided to part with it, a guy came over to value it, and he said, I've never seen a collection like this in my entire career of valuing sports memorabilia, because it was three sports and champion NBA championship stuff and Henry Aaron and all these guys. And he said, I'd like to fly you to New York to put this stuff at auction and fly the whole family and everything. And she just about fainted, you know. And she suddenly learned the value of
Well, you didn't just become they pick you out of the hat here as the equipment manager. You started obviously with the Bucks before that, and partly if I remember rightly, based on the good job you did with the Brewers.
Yeah, I actually what happened was I'd won a transistor radio from my paper route. So I was listening to the transistor radio when the Bucks won the coin flip to get Lou Alcindor, the first choice in the NBA draft. And the moment they did that, I ran to the phone, and I dialed on our rotary phone, which nobody remembers anymore, and I called the Bucks, which was incredibly bad timing because they were celebrating like crazy. But a very kind woman answered the phone, and she said hello, and I said, how do you get a job as a ball boy with the Bucks? And she said, well, your timing's amazing. We're interviewing tomorrow. I'll put your name on the list. And I took a bus downtown, and I interviewed with about 100 kids. And I got picked, and I believe it's because I'd had experience that summer with the Brewers, and I knew how to act around. But I interviewed with the general manager, the coach, the trainer, and the equipment manager. I mean, one of the general manager at the time was Johnny Erickson, former coach of the Badgers. And, I mean, who would interview kids today with that lineup, right? And I got picked, and I started the exact same day that Kareem Abdul-Jabbar started. And when he walked into that locker room, I was standing in there, and he was bent in half, and he just stood up, you know, like a giraffe, you know, 7'3" and an 8th. And suddenly I'm on the bench with Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and John McLaughlin and all these wonderful people, and they were really wonderful people. There's a big difference between a basketball player, a baseball player, and a football player that we could get into. But I had the enormous privilege working with the Bucks, and I worked as hard as I possibly could in that job, and that's why I was picked out of the pack of kids to be the equipment manager.
And you were there how many? What?
7 years.
7 years, but when you were picked as equipment, as the first time you were picked, how old were you again?
I was just had turned 18. I was in my senior year in high school.
Yeah.
$150,000 budget. I had to buy all the uniforms and organize every game and go on the road. And yeah.
At 18?
18. Yeah.
Still in high school.
Yeah. balance my homework and all that.
And balance. And I would also say that I think that was from the age of 12. You were responsible, financially responsible, kind of for almost everything. You had to pay for buy your own clothes and things of that.
Yeah,
nature.
In our family, there were seven kids, and all seven of us, starting at age 12, we had to pay it. For everything starting at age 12, we never got a dime from our parents after age 12. We were financially responsible for school fees and clothes and transportation and everything. That's just the way it was, you know, post-depression kids.
Yeah. And you were, you had a, in addition to working for the teams, you had a paper out and.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had five jobs generally. You know, I was working at a car dealership when the teams were out of town, and I was washing cars and detailing, and I also worked at school. I was the assistant trainer for UWM when I started there. I was the trainer at my high school before that. And so I was always trying to find odd jobs. I was mowing grass, and I worked at Baskin-Robbins scooping ice cream. Yeah, I did whatever I could.
Well, we've talked a little about the Bucks and the Brewers, but you also probably experience wasn't as great with the Packers. Although you won't, how'd you wind up with the Packers?
Well, you know, the Packers played 5 games in Milwaukee in those years. You know, Vince Lombardi was very afraid that the NFL was going to put a team in Milwaukee, so he put games in Milwaukee County Stadium. So, because I worked really hard for the Brewers games, you know, Jim Kaczynski, this terrific guy, said to me, how would you like to work the Packer games in the fall? And that was right after the Packers had won the first 2 Super Bowls. And the question was, how would you like to work for the Packers? Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, you don't have to ask a kid twice, you know. So they still had Bart Starr and Ray Nitschke and Willie Wood and all these guys. So I was just over the moon. I mean, a huge Packer fan at that time, of course. And I'll tell you what was really different is the Packers and the visiting team would show up on Saturday just for a quick warm-up practice. And we'd unload all the uniforms. And it was really fun. After we'd unload the uniforms, Jim would say, go grab a uniform, put it on, we'll take a picture, you know. So we'd pick some star player. I got some great pictures of me in different uniforms. But then the players would show up, and unfortunately, we didn't get to know them during the week. We'd only see them when they were completely jacked up for this game, you know. And football players on Sunday are just, the adrenaline is so high, you know. And they literally almost can't communicate. And they're smashing into each other, and they're smashing into the wall. And so we didn't get to know them. Baseball players are very relaxed. They're there for 3 or 4 days, and they're funny. And, you know, they come from high school into the minor leagues, and they act like high schoolers and for the most part. And basketball players had college degrees, and they were intellectual, and they were they played chess and read books and listened to jazz, and they were very fun to be around. And football players were just crazy. And I expected to enjoy football almost the most, to be honest with you, and I enjoyed it the least. It was we crammed 80 guys into a locker room that was built for 35 baseball players, and it was a pile of mud and dirt and blood and sweat. It was very difficult. It took us about 3 times longer to clean up that locker room after the game than it would for baseball.
Yeah, and equipment, more equipment.
Oh. Trunks and trunks of equipment, you know, shoulder pads and cleats and capes and, you know, and we're dragging all that stuff, and the game was cold, and, you know, the players were very demanding. It's a very demanding sport.
And you learn, I mean, the people that you worked with, you had the 2 Mikes, mm-hmm. for example, and Big Jim, I mean, those folks had an impact on you, too.
I worked with 2 gentlemen, Mike Doyle and Mike Wojak, that were in the seminary while working in a baseball and football locker room, and the players oftentimes didn't know it, and they'd swear a lot. And then they'd find out they were priests to be, and those 2 priests, by the way, did our wedding. My wife and I have been married for 42 years, and they're very special to me. And they had a tremendous influence on me as a young man, which was a really important part of that whole growing up. Jim Kaczynski, the 2 Mikes, Arnie Garber, the trainer, and Wayne Embry as the general manager of the Bucks. They were my mentors. They were parents to me. And these gentlemen, you know, to have people come into your life at that critical time as a teenager and set an example to be role models, that completely changed my life. That made me who I am today.
Well, and Wayne Embry, I mean, when you were equipment manager for the Bucks, you had to sit down with Wayne, and here you are, 18 years old, mm-hmm. sit down with Wayne Embry and tell him how you were going to spend the $100,000 or ask for a certain amount of money.
So here's Wayne Embry. He's 6'8", 350 pounds, the former backup center to Bill Russell of the Celtics. Brilliant man. And I'd walk into his office and have to negotiate a $150 budget. And he'd say, why do we need so many towels, Irish? That's what he'd call me. And I'd say, Wayne, you know, we have all these players. And I'd say, well, I'd like to do this design of the uniforms. We need a different design, you know. And I'm a high schooler. But I learned some incredible lessons from Wayne Embry. I'd just like to tell one really quick story, if I could, Larry. I think this is one of the most critical stories in the book. Wayne Embry, of course, played in Boston, and it was a very segregated city, as Milwaukee was when I grew up. It was considered the most segregated city in America. And we were in a training camp, and he said, you know, I'm going to have to keep several white players. And I said, well, Wayne, no, don't do that. You just keep the 12 best players, you know. He said, I can't do that. We won't be able to sell tickets. And I said, Wayne, that's ridiculous. Just keep the 12 best players. And he said, I'm not going to be able to do that. I'm going to have to make sure that there's a, you know, mix of race on the team. And I said, Wayne, that just doesn't make sense to me. And he stood up and he squeezed my shoulder and he walked down toward the court. And I looked at this giant hulk of a man that I realized had been through all the discrimination of having to eat in different restaurants and not being able to stay in the same hotels and, you know, being called names. And I realized, geez, here I am, a 19-year-old kid trying to say that kind of thing to a guy like that. And I, in a moment, realized I was getting this incredible lesson on racial justice. It was powerful. I really respected Wayne Embry.
And there are a lot of fun stories in the book.
Oh, yeah.
We've got about, maybe a minute. We got another fun story?
Sure, I'll tell you a great story. You know, a lot of times the stadium wasn't covered, so we'd have these rain delays, and they'd put a tarp on the field. And baseball players are funny guys, and they'd say, take this message over to this guy. I want to party with him afterwards. So I was running this message from a player on a visiting team over to Mike Keegan, the famous announcer to the Brewers. And I was running the message over, and all the fans were waiting for the rain delay. And I'm sprinting across the field, you know, doing my thing. And I hit the rain tarp, and it was this big puddle. And I do this big wipeout and do a big spray. And I get a standing ovation from the 30,000 fans in the field. So, you know, I had a few moments where I got some recognition from the fans.
Well, you have written a book, a fascinating book, Pat, and we certainly haven't gotten through all of it by any means at all. I want to thank you so much for writing it. I really, really enjoyed reading it. I know a lot of people. Have you been selling a few?
Oh, it's sold quite well, yeah. And it's in a lot of public libraries and a lot of bookstores around the state. So thank you so much, Larry.
It's been a real pleasure. Patrick McBride, the author, we didn't talk about his time as a doctor, but some of that's in his book as well. But many, many other stories about the famous sports people that he worked with in his time with the Bucks, with the Brewers, and with the Packers. And the book title is The Luckiest Boy in the World. Take a look. Forward, by the way, forwards by Eddie Doucette, the great announcer listened to many a time, and John McLaughlin. And they are also great friends with Pat McBride. He's got a lot of friends, that's for sure, and he's got a heck of a story to tell. And he tells it well in his book, The Luckiest Boy in the World. Take a look at it. You're going to like it. Well, I hope you're going to like what's on tomorrow, too, because tomorrow Scott Craven's back. It's a wildlife show. It's Wednesday, and he'll be back to talk about turkeys and bird breeding behavior and a whole lot more and answer all your questions. That's tomorrow at 11. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.